Anahata, on opening the sutra. The Dharma, incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
So creations are numberless. I vow to free them. The many beings are numberless. I vow to save them. These are two versions of the first of the four bodhisattva vows that we recite at the end of each day of practice. What do we mean when we say that we're going to free or save all creations? For me, when we speak about freeing or saving all beings or creations in this context, I understand that phrase to mean that we are working to relieve their suffering, thereby freeing them to live each moment of their lives fully, with a reasonable degree of peace and comfort, in spite of the numerous difficulties that are inevitably part of our lives. Clearly, if we understand this vow in the ordinary, relative sense, there is no way that we can accomplish it. However, there is an absolute sense in which it's possible. It is reported that while sitting under the Bodhi tree at the moment of his enlightenment, Shakyamuni Buddha said, "I, the great earth, and all beings are at this moment enlightened." I, the great earth, and all beings. Nothing is excluded from the Buddha's enlightenment. The whole universe is transformed. It is really impossible to comprehend the meaning of this statement with our intellect. However, I find that the metaphor of the one body can enable us to gain a very rudimentary understanding of what functions in a very similar way. At an even more fundamental level, our body is a vast interconnected web of trillions of molecules. Within each molecule of our body, there are vast reaches of empty space, just as there are within the universe that surrounds us. However, that space does not make each atom of our body a separate entity. They are all interwoven into the whole. The same holds true for the great universe. In truth, there are no boundaries and no separations. The universe exists as a vast interconnected web, which we call the diamond net of Indra. That web is depicted as having a many-faceted diamond at each intersection, reflecting every other diamond in the web. I believe that web, stretching from the molecules of our body to the furthest stars, is the fundamental aspect of what the Buddha saw at that moment. So, in the absolute sense, if we practice until we realize profound awakening, the whole universe is awakened, and all creations are thereby freed from suffering. That is the basis of a position that some practitioners take, that all we need to do is sit on the cushions and practice until that moment occurs and our vow will be fulfilled. However, we also know that while deep realization of the absolute is the central task of our practice, the absolute and the relative are an inseparable whole. If we give exclusive attention to one, we do so at the expense of the other. The Buddha had his awakening 2,500 years ago, but clearly suffering in the world was not extinguished. In fact, the Buddha's very first teaching after his enlightenment was the very pragmatic Four Noble Truths, which are grounded in the seamless reality that is neither absolute nor relative. Loosely stated, the first of those truths points to the reality of suffering. In every human life there is pain, sickness, loss, and death. These are the manifestations of impermanence, the reality that everything in this universe changes, decays, and eventually extinguishes. The second truth is that there is a cause of suffering. That cause is our refusal to accept the reality of our condition, our resistance to impermanence and its consequences. We refer to this as our attachments and our delusions. The third truth is that there's a possibility of bringing an end to suffering. And the fourth truth is that there is a path to accomplish that end, the Eightfold Noble Path. The elements of that noble path are right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This path is often seen as the path of personal liberation, the path to end our own suffering. However, from the perspective of Mahayana Buddhism, of which Zen is a part, it can be seen as a very concrete, pragmatic means to fulfill our bodhisattva vows to end the suffering of all beings. Right view is, in fact, practicing the way of not holding any views at all. We sometimes talk about that as not knowing. We approach every situation from a perspective that is fresh and new without imposing fixed conceptual frameworks or judgment. This allows us to act freely in a manner which is appropriate to the circumstance, a manner that allows for our compassion to flow freely. Right intention is the desire to improve ourselves, to live our lives in the best way possible, to manifest compassion for all beings. The term bodhicitta refers to our innate desire to awaken and to fulfill the bodhisattva ideal. I would suggest that is very close to right intention. Right speech means that we avoid speaking in ways that are negative or harmful. We understand that our words are powerful, and to the best of our ability, we avoid destructive language, choosing to use our speech to manifest compassion and help other beings. That is the positive understanding of right speech, using the vehicle of our verbal ability to benefit the world and all of its beings. Right action can be understood as living in accord with the Buddhist precepts, which define the way in which Buddhists live their lives. In those 16 precepts, we vow to take up the way of not killing, of not stealing, of not telling lies, of not misusing sex, of not talking about others' errors and faults, and so on. Through following those precepts, we minimize the harm that we are doing. However, there's also a positive way to understand them. For example, giving life and protecting all life is the positive understanding of the way of not killing. Right livelihood is generally seen as avoiding any type of means of making a living that involves killing or destruction. However, here too there's a positive way of understanding. Our work should benefit others, contributing to the welfare of the whole. Right effort is the process of working to eliminate the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, the negative states within our own mind, while at the same time cultivating positive qualities, compassion, and loving kindness. Right mindfulness is paying attention to our thoughts and actions, constantly being aware of the fact that we are continually impacting other beings and the entire universe. Finally, right concentration reminds us of the importance of meditation practice, of working to the state where we are not prisoners of our own attachments and delusions, but dwelling free in relative calm and equanimity, therefore being open to the needs of others and being open and available to helping them. Through living our lives in a manner that strives to fulfill the Eightfold Path, we begin to fulfill this first Bodhisattva vow. Because to the extent that we are able to stay on this path and keep the precepts, our thoughts and actions contribute to the healing of the one body and all of its many beings. We are able to manifest loving kindness and compassion, thereby lessening the suffering of all beings. However, it is essential that we recognize that this is an active process that we must engage in every moment of our day, every day of our lives. If instead of paying careful attention to these eight aspects of living, we allow ourselves to function on autopilot, we quickly revert to old patterns of negative thinking and harmful actions. Of course, no matter how diligently we work towards it, we will never see the fulfillment of this vow in our lifetime. Those persons who believe that there are multiple lifetimes therefore feel that we need to return time and again to continue this work. I feel that regardless of whether this is our only life or one of a series, the taking of this vow is not a rational act based on a calculus of its attainability. Perhaps taking the vow is an act of faith, or perhaps a bit of insanity. Perhaps we simply have no other choice. Something deep in our being knows that this is how we are meant to live this human life. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. The many beings are numberless. I vow to save them.
I think we find out how this really works when we do Fusatsu, if we do it properly. Because that, going through the precepts, on a very personal, detailed level, keeps us from philosophizing and theorizing and saying, well, that sounds really good, but that doesn't matter if we do not manifest it or are not aware of how we act, either in accord or in discord with the precepts.
Do you want to explain what Fusatsu is? Because we have like a couple of people who probably don't know.
Once a month, we chant the precepts. And then if people are... Each month is assigned one of the precepts. And people are encouraged to speak about how their understanding of the precept has changed or has not changed, or anything on a personal level that is significant to them about that particular precept. We specifically stay away from generalizing, keep it on a very individual basis.
Yeah, so I thought I would read the precepts, all of them, all 16 of them. So the precepts start with, I vow to be one with the Buddha, I vow to be one with the Dharma, and I vow to be one with the Sangha. Then it's, I vow to cease from evil, I vow to do good, and I vow to do good for others. I vow to take up the way of not killing, I vow to take up the way of not stealing, I vow to take up the way of not being greedy, I vow to take up the way of not telling lies, I vow to take up the way of not being ignorant, I vow to take up the way of not talking about others' errors or faults, I vow to take up the way of not elevating myself and blaming others. I vow to take up the way of not being stingy. I vow to take up the way of not being angry. I vow to take up the way of not speaking ill of the three treasures, which are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I vow to take up the way of loving kindness and nonviolence. Those are the 16 precepts that we follow.
I guess we have our work cut out for us.
Exactly.
And that is a very active process. It's not a passive one.
It's a very active process. That's the application, or at least one of the applications of all of this. I don't think I keep one precept one day. I think I screw up every one of them every single day. It's not easy. It's not. These things pop up, the selfish thoughts pop up, the talking about errors, others' errors and faults. I'm very good at that, you know. Not elevating myself and blaming. I mean, these are not easy. These are not easy, you know. They were originally created by the Buddha to help maintain harmony within the Sangha. You know, that the way that at the time of his life, what used to happen was the monks and nuns would be on the road throughout most of the year. But when the rainy season came, they would gather together and live together for several months. And that was the time of the year when the Buddha did his teaching and everybody practiced and meditated together. And when the rain stopped, everybody again went off to travel to the countryside and so on. But so in part, and there used to be a lot more. I mean, I don't know. I can't even remember. There was like 173 precepts for men, and then women had like 354 precepts.
It must have been the other way around. I'm sure of it.
Well, it wasn't. Those were not enlightened times.
Not
enlightened times. But that said, the whole world is our Sangha. The whole world is our community. We have neighbors. Some of our neighbors have wings, and some of our neighbors walk on four legs and some on two legs, and so it's all very important and never easy. You're so right. It's such a hard project. You know, because why? Because we're human. You know, we're human. You know, we screw up. We forget. We're forgetful. So that's what we're striving to do. Again, I talked about that right mindfulness. You know, it's kind of like, you know, we fall back into our old ways. We're not paying attention. We're, you know, or reacting out of old, you know, old habits. We have to pay attention.
I don't know if it ever gets easy, but I do believe, for me, it gets easier with practice.
Well, I suppose that's true. That's certainly true, if it's true for you, you know, but Yeah, I mean, I find it variable. You know, sometimes it's easier for me and then harder, and, you know, it depends mm-hmm. kind of what's, you know, going on in my life.
But those hard times when it's something going on in your life is just, that's grist for the mill, for the practice.
Yeah, it is. That's why we have to sustain. You know, the easiest place to practice is here. Right? I mean, people, oh, so hard, you got to sit in the pillow. You know? This is the easiest place to practice. Mm-hmm. It's when we walk out that door that the challenges start.
When you're stuck in a 26-foot travel trailer with your husband for 5 months, the practice occurs. And I mean that very nicely. Overall.
I noticed you said your husband, you didn't mention the dog.
Oh, the dog was, you know, dog was amazing. She taught us.
I try to be of benefit by giving my wife stuff to practice with.
I'm sure you are of benefit. You know, honey, may this be a benefit for you.
Yeah, I give her lots.
She goes right back at you.
I give her lots to practice with. You know, no, but in all seriousness, that was a crack, but in all seriousness, like, I think looking deeply at my own faults and failings really makes it a lot easier to have that compassion for others, because
yeah, there's a book by Henri Nouwen, French name, The Wounded Healer. I don't know if anybody's encountered that. You've probably read, mm-hmm. seen it. It comes from a Christian perspective, but it's the same idea that, you know, the place that seeing our own wounds and seeing our own failings and all that is the way that we are able to have compassion for others. Because we understand, you know, if we think we're perfect, then like everybody else is inferior to us. But if we understand, no, we're all human. We all make mistakes. We all hurt people we love when we don't mean to, and so on and so forth. You know, and you know, that's the project. That's what we're working on.
I have noticed, though, in Al-Anon meetings, that it's very possible to forget where you came from. I mean, you may not cry every meeting anymore, but sometimes it's easy to forget that you were in exactly the same place that someone else is that very day. So we do manipulate our memories to forget pain, I guess. But that sometimes gets in the way of understanding.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.
One comment as we get on the half-day sit, which we did, you know. I think it's really nice to have that little bit longer sit. And we won't have it again now till the fall because next month is the big retreat, and July and August typically are time.